The day of the bombings, analysts at the Forsvarets forskningsinstitutt, a Norwegian think tank near Oslo, retrieved a document that they had noticed on an Islamist website the previous December. At the time, the document had not made a big impression. But now, in light of the events in Madrid, it read like a terrorist roadmap. Titled Jihadi Iraq, Hopes and Dangers, it had been prepared by a previously unknown entity called the Media Committee for the Victory of the Iraqi People, Mujahideen Services Center. The document, which is 42 pages long and appears to be the work of several anonymous authors, begins with the proposition that although coalition forces in Iraq, led by America, could not be defeated by a guerrilla insurgency, individual partners of the coalition could be muscled out, leaving America more vulnerable and discouraged as casualties increased and the expenses became insupportable. Three countries, Britain, Spain, and Poland, formed the European backbone of the coalition. Poland appeared to be the most resolute, because the populace largely agreed with the government's decision to enter Iraq. In Britain, the war was generally deplored. Before the war, in February, about 1 million people went out on a huge march, filling the streets of London, the document notes. This was the biggest march of political protest in the history of Britain. But the authors suggest that the British would not withdraw unless the casualty count sharply increased. Spain, however, presented a striking opportunity. The war was almost universally unpopular. Aznar had plunged his country into Iraq without seeking a consensus, unlike other coalition leaders. If the disparity between the government and the people were at the same percentage rate in Britain, then the Blair government would fall, the author of this section observes. The reason Aznar had not yet been ousted, the author claims, was that Spain is an immature democracy and does not have a firm tradition of holding its rulers accountable. Right-wing Spanish voters also tended to be more loyal and organized than their leftist counterparts. Moreover, there had been fewer than a dozen Spanish casualties in Iraq. In order to force the Spanish government to withdraw from Iraq, the resistance should deal painful blows to its forces, the writer proposes. It is necessary to make utmost use of the upcoming general election in Spain in March next year. We think that the Spanish government could not tolerate more than 2, maximum 3 blows, after which it will have to withdraw as a result of popular pressure. If its troops still remain in Iraq after these blows, the victory of the Socialist Party is almost secured, and the withdrawal of the Spanish forces will be on its electoral program. Once Spain pulled out of Iraq, the author theorizes, the pressure on Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, to do the same might be unbearable, and hence the domino tiles would fall quickly. The document specifies that the attacks would be aimed at Spanish forces within Iraq. There is no call for action in Spain. Nonetheless, the author's reading of the Western political calendar struck the Norwegian researchers as particularly keen. The relation between the text and the bombings is unclear. Thomas Haghammer, a researcher at Forsvarets forskningsinstitutt, told me. But without the text, we would still be asking, is this a coincidence? That day, Haghammer forwarded a copy of the document to Haizam Amira Fernandez, a colleague at Madrid's Real Instituto Elcano. Amira was shocked. Until now, the announced goals of Al-Qaeda had been mainly parochial, directed at purging the Islamic world, especially Saudi Arabia, of Western influences, overturning the established Arabic governments, and restoring the clerical rule of the ancient caliphate and purifying Islam by returning it to the idealized time of the prophet. In an audio tape aired on the Arabic satellite channel Al Jazeera in February 2003, Osama bin Laden had identified Jordan, Morocco, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen as the most qualified regions for liberation. Iraq was notably absent from his list. And yet, he offered no political platform, no plan, for instance, for governing Saudi Arabia on the morning after the revolution. As for the rest of the world, bin Laden's goals seemed to be motivated mainly by revenge. In 1998, he had decreed that it was the duty of every Muslim to kill Americans and their allies. The spectacular violence that characterized al-Qaeda's attacks was not a means to a goal. It was the goal. Success was to be measured by body count, not by political change. The internet document suggested that a new intelligence was at work, a rationality not seen in al-Qaeda documents before. The Mujahideen Services Center, whatever that was, appeared to operate as a kind of Islamist think tank. The person who put together those chapters had a clear strategic vision, realistic and well thought out, Amira says. He told Heghammer, "This is political science applied to jihad." Although the document was posted on the internet in December 2003, the authors note that a draft had been written in September. In October, assassins shot a Spanish military attaché in Iraq, José Antonio Bernal Gómez, near his residence. In November, seven Spanish intelligence agents were ambushed and murdered south of Baghdad. Photographs of the killers standing on the agents' bodies circulated on Islamist websites. Another internet document soon appeared, titled Message to the Spanish People, which threatened more attacks. "Return to your country and live peacefully," it demands, "or else the battalions of the Iraqi resistance and its supporters outside of Iraq are able to increase the dosage and will eclipse your memory of the rotten spies." Variations in the Arabic transcriptions of English words in the Jihadi Iraq document suggested to Amira that writers of different nationalities had drafted it. For instance, in some cases the T in Tony Blair's name was transcribed with the Arabic ta. But in the section about Spain, the author used the da, which was more typical of the Moroccan dialect. Also characteristic of Morocco was the use of Arabic numerals, the style used in the West, in place of the numbering system that was common from Egypt to the Persian Gulf. Those clues, plus certain particularly Moroccan political concerns expressed in the document, such as the independence movement in Western Sahara, suggested that at least some of the authors were diaspora Moroccans, probably living in Spain. The link between the internet document and the bombings soon became clearer. There was a reference early in the document to Abu Dujana, a companion of the prophet who was known for his ferocity in battle. His name had been invoked by other jihadis, notably in the suicide bombings at the JW Marriott Hotel in Jakarta in August 2003. On Saturday evening, a television station in Madrid received a call from a man speaking Spanish with a Moroccan accent, who said that a videotape had been placed in a trash bin near the city's main mosque. "We declare our responsibility for what has occurred in Madrid, exactly 2.5 years after the attacks on New York and Washington," a masked speaker on the videotape said. He identified himself as Abu Dujan al-Afghani, the military spokesman for al-Qaeda in Europe. He continued, It is a response to your collaboration with the criminal Bush and his allies. You love life, and we love death, which gives an example of what the Prophet Muhammad said. If you don't stop your injustices, more and more blood will flow. Until this tape appeared, even those investigators who were arguing that the train bombings were perpetrated by Islamic terrorists, not ETA, had been troubled by the fact that there were no martyrs in the attacks. It was a trademark of Al-Qaeda to sacrifice its killers, thus providing a scanty moral cover for what would otherwise be seen simply as mass murder. When the investigators saw that the man calling himself Abu Dujan al-Afghani was dressed in white funeral robes, however, they realized that suicide was on the horizon. The Al-Qaeda cell in Spain was old and well-established. Mohammed Atta, the commander of the September 11th attacks, came to Spain twice in 2001. The second time was in July, for a meeting in the coastal resort of Salao, which appears to have been arranged as a final go-ahead for the attacks. After September 11th, Spanish police estimated that there were 300 Islamic radicals in the country who might be affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Even before then, members of the Spanish cell had been monitored by police agencies, as was evident from the abundant use of wiretaps and surveillance information in indictments that were issued in November 2001, when 11 suspects were charged with being Al-Qaeda members, the first of several terrorist roundups. And yet, according to Spanish police officials, at the time of the Madrid attacks, there was not a single Arabic-speaking intelligence agent in the country. Al-Qaeda was simply not seen as a threat to Spain. "We never believed we were a real target," a senior police official admitted. "That's the reality." At 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, 60 hours after the attacks and the day before the elections, Interior Minister Acebes announced the arrest of Jamal Zougam and two other Moroccans. Still, he continued to point at ETA. But by now, the socialists were publicly accusing the government of lying about the investigation in order to stay in power. Polls opened the next morning at 9. 35 million people voted, more than 77% of the electorate, 8% more than expected. Many were young, first-time voters, and their votes put the socialists over the top. As José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero declared victory, he again condemned the war in Iraq and reiterated his intention to withdraw troops. 4 days later, the Abu Hafs al-Masri Brigades, a group claiming affiliation with Al-Qaeda, sent a message to the London newspaper Al-Quds al-Arabi, avowing responsibility for the train bombings. "Whose turn will it be next?" the authors taunt. "Is it Japan, America, Italy, Britain, Saudi Arabia, or Australia?" The message also addresses the speculation that the terrorists would try to replicate their political success in Spain by disrupting the U.S. elections in November. "We are very keen that Bush does not lose the upcoming elections," the authors write. "Bush's idiocy and religious fanaticism are useful," the authors contend, "for they stir the Islamic world to action." On April 2nd, 2 weeks after the election, a security guard for the AVE, Spain's high-speed train line, discovered a blue plastic bag beside the tracks 40 miles south of Madrid. Inside the bag were 26 pounds of goma too. 450 feet of cable had been draped across the security fence and attached, incorrectly, to the detonator. Had the bomb gone off when the AVE passed by at 180 miles per hour, carrying 1,200 passengers, the results could have been far more catastrophic than those of March 11th. Spanish citizens asked themselves, if the bombings of March 11th had accomplished the goals set by Al-Qaeda, what was the point of April 2nd? Until the Madrid attacks, the Al-Qaeda operations in Tehran, Nairobi, Dar es Salaam, Aden, New York, Washington, Djerba, Karachi, Bali, Mombasa, Riyadh, Casablanca, Jakarta, and Istanbul had been political failures. The massacres committed in the name of jihad had achieved little except anger, grief, and the deaths of thousands. Soon after September 11th, Al-Qaeda lost its base in Afghanistan, and along with that, its singular role in the coordination of international terror. New groups, such as the bombers in Madrid, were acting in the name of Al-Qaeda, and although they may well have had the blessings of its leaders, they did not have the training, resources, or international contacts that had bolstered the previous generation of terrorists. Some operations, such as the 2003 attack on Western compounds in Riyadh, which killed mainly Muslims, were such fiascos that it appeared that Al-Qaeda was no longer able to exercise control. Al-Qaeda was always a social movement. Mark Sageman, a psychiatrist, a former CIA case officer, and the author of Understanding Terror Networks, told me. He pointed out that the latest converts to the cause didn't spend time in Afghanistan, and they approach jihad differently. These local guys are reckless and less well-trained, but they're willing to kill themselves, whereas the previous leaders were not, Sageman said. Moreover, as the Spanish attacks showed, the new generation was more interested in committing violence for the sake of immediate political gain. The kind of short-term tactical thinking displayed in the Jihadi Iraq document and the March 11th bombings is decidedly out of step with Al-Qaeda's traditional worldview, in which history is seen as an endless struggle between believers and infidels, the mindset of fundamentalists of all religions. That war is eternal, and is never finally won until the longed-for Day of Judgment. In this contest, the first goal is to provoke conflict. Bold, violent deeds draw the lines and arouse ancient resentments and are useful even if they have unsought consequences. Polarization is to be encouraged, radical simplicity being essential for religious warfare. An Al-Qaeda statement posted on the internet after the March 11th bombings declared, "Being targeted by an enemy is what will wake us from our slumber." Seen in this light, terrorism plays a sacramental role, dramatizing a religious conflict by giving it an apocalyptic backdrop. And Madrid was just another step in the relentless march of radical Islam against the modern secular world. Had the Madrid cell rested on its accomplishment after March 11th, Al-Qaeda would properly be seen as an organization now being guided by political strategists, as an entity closer in spirit to ETA, with clear tactical objectives. April 2nd throws doubt on that perspective. There was little to be gained politically from striking an opponent who was complying with a stated demand. After all, the government had capitulated and withdrawn troops from Iraq. If the point was merely humiliation or revenge, then April 2nd makes more sense. The terrorists wanted more blood, even if a second attack backfired politically. The socialists would hardly have been able to continue following the terrorist agenda with 1,000 new corpses along the tracks. April 2nd is comprehensible only if the real goal of the bombers was not Iraq, but Spain, where the Islamic Empire began its retreat 500 years ago. In the weeks after the March 11th attacks, Spanish police combed the immigrant neighborhoods outside Madrid, carrying photographs of suspects. We didn't have them perfectly located, but we knew they were in Leganés, a police official told me. Leganés is a bland suburb of uniform five-story red-brick apartment complexes. The wide streets are lined with evenly spaced adolescent oaks. In the mornings, the sidewalks teem with commuters rushing for the trains. Then the place is vacant, except for grandmothers and strollers. In the evenings, the commuters return and close their doors. At 3 o'clock on the afternoon of April 3rd, the day after the discovery of the bomb on the Ave tracks, police approached an apartment building on Calle de Carmen Martín Gaite. They saw a young Moroccan man with a baseball cap on backward who was taking out trash. He yelled something in Arabic, then ran away at an impressive pace. He turned out to be a track champion. The police could not catch him. A moment later, voices cried out, "Allahu Akbar!" and machine gun fire from the second floor of the apartment house raked the street, scattering the cops. Over the next few hours, the police tactical unit, Grupo Especial de Operaciones, evacuated the residents of nearby apartments. Tanks and helicopters moved in, and the siege of Leganés began. Inside the apartment were seven young men. Most of them were Moroccan immigrants who had come to Europe seeking economic opportunity. They had gone through a period of becoming westernized. That is to say, they had been drinkers, drug dealers, womanizers. They hung out in cyber cafes. They folded into the ethnic mix of urban Madrid. But they also lived in the European underground of Islamic radicalism, whose members were recruited more often in prison than in the training camps of Afghanistan. Their leader was Sarhan ben Abdelmajid Faket, who was 35 years old and had a round, fleshy face and a patchy beard. He was a real estate agent who had come to Madrid 8 years earlier on a scholarship to study economics. His boss told the Spanish press that Faket was a wonderful salesman who held the record for the number of apartments sold in a month. Yet he did not talk to his co-workers or make friends with other Spaniards. He remained sequestered in his Muslim world. He was very soft and well-educated. Munir Mahmoud Ali El-Mesri, the imam at the principal mosque in Madrid, told me. The mosque, a massive marble structure built with Saudi money, was the center of Muslim cultural life in the Spanish capital. It overlooked the M30, one of the freeways that ring Madrid. When Faket was a student, he worked in a restaurant attached to the mosque, and he sometimes came to Mesri's weekly religion class. In the beginning, the imam noticed that Faket spoke familiarly to women as well as to men. Then, for 3 or 4 years, I sensed that he had some extremist thoughts, Mesri recalled. After class, Faket would ask provocative questions, such as whether the imam thought that the leaders of the Arab countries were true believers, or if Islam authorized the use of force to spread the religion. He married a 16-year-old Moroccan girl who veiled her face and dressed entirely in black, including gloves. His performance at work declined, and he eventually stopped showing up altogether. He began attending meetings with a small group of fellow Muslims at a barber shop in Madrid, where the men would drink holy water from Mecca. Police believed that this ritual was aimed at absolving the men of the sin of suicide, which is condemned by Islam. Soon after the attacks of September 11th, the imam had a dream about Faket. Sarhan was in his kitchen, cooking on the stove, he recalled. I saw what he was cooking was a big pot of worms. He tried to give me a plate of the food to eat. I said no. I said, please clean the kitchen. Days later, the imam confronted Faket with the dream. This is a message from God, the imam said to him. The kitchen is the thought, and the thought is dirty. Faket didn't respond. He's a very cold person, the imam told me. Faket was not the only young man in the M30 mosque who had taken a turn toward extremism. Amir Azizi, a 36-year-old Moroccan who was a veteran of jihad in Bosnia and Afghanistan, had been indicted in Spain for helping to plan the September 11th attacks. He was accused of setting up the July 2001 meeting between Mohammed Atta and other conspirators in Salau. Among people who frequented the mosque, Azizi had a reputation as a drug addict, although he attended some classes on Islam along with Faket. In June 2000, when the Arab countries' ambassadors to Spain came to the mosque to mourn the death of the Syrian dictator Hafez al-Assad, Azizi insulted them, yelling, "Why do you come to pray for an infidel?" Police eventually charged him with being a senior member of Al-Qaeda and the leader of the Moroccan Islamic Combat Group, which was responsible for 5 bombings in Casablanca in May 2003. He fled Spain just before his indictment. Another of Faket's friends was Jamal Amidan, a drug dealer who police say financed the March 11th bombings with 70 pounds of hashish. Mesri blamed an Islamist cleric in London, Abu Qatada, a radical Palestinian from Jordan who emigrated to Britain as a refugee in 1994. After September 11th, police in Hamburg found 18 tapes of Abu Qatada's sermons in Mohammed Atta's apartment there. British authorities arrested him in October 2002. But he continued to wield great authority among Islamists around the world. The imam told me, it was as if there were black hands behind a curtain pushing these young men. At 6 o'clock in the evening on April 3rd, 3 hours after the start of the Leganés siege, a handwritten fax in Arabic, signed by Abu Dujan al-Afghani, arrived at ABC, a conservative daily in Madrid, referring to the bomb found beside the Ave tracks the day before. The author argues that it failed to explode because our objective was only to warn you and show you that we have the power and capacity, with the permission of Allah, to attack you when and how we want. The letter demanded that Spain withdraw its troops from both Iraq and Afghanistan by the following Sunday. Otherwise, we will turn Spain into an inferno and make your blood flow like rivers. On the surface, the facts represented another turn toward tactical political thinking. More likely, it was an attempt to salvage a bungled operation. Outside the Leganés apartment, the police attempted to negotiate, but the cornered terrorists cried out, "We will die killing!" Phone calls that they made to relatives during the siege confirmed their intentions. They also attempted to call Abu Qatada in London's Belmarsh prison, apparently seeking a fatwa that would morally sanction their suicide. Instead of turning off the electricity and waiting them out, the police decided to storm the apartment. They ordered the terrorists to come out, naked and with your hands up. One of the occupants responded, "Come in and we'll talk." At 9:05 p.m., the police blew the lock on the door and fired tear gas into the room. Almost immediately, an explosion shattered the apartment, killing the terrorists and a police officer. The blast was so intense that it took days before the authorities could determine how many people had been in the apartment. The body of Jamal Amidan was hurled through the walls and into a swimming pool. In the ruins, police found 22 pounds of Goma II and 200 copper detonators that were similar to those used in the train bombings. They also found the shredded remains of a videotape. The fragments were painstakingly reassembled to the point where police could view the final statement of Faket and two other members of the cell, which called itself the Brigade situated in Al-Andalus. Unless Spanish troops left Iraq within a week, the men had declared, we will continue our jihad until martyrdom in the land of Tariq ibn Zayad. Al-Andalus is the Arabic name for the portion of Spain that fell to Muslim armies after the invasion by the Berber general Tariq ibn Zayad in 711. It includes not only the southern region of Andalusia, but most of the Iberian Peninsula. For 800 years, Al-Andalus remained in Islamic hands. You know of the Spanish crusade against Muslims, and that not much time has passed since the expulsion from Al-Andalus and the tribunals of the Inquisition, Faket says on the tape. He is referring to 1492, when King Ferdinand of Aragon and Queen Isabella of Castile completed the reconquest of Spain, forcing Jews and Muslims to convert to Catholicism or leave the Iberian Peninsula. Blood for blood, Faket shouts. Destruction for destruction. Were these the true goals of Al-Qaeda? Were the besieged terrorists in Leganés simply struggling to get Spain out of Iraq? Or were they also battling to regain the lost colonies of Islam? In other words, were these terrorists who might respond to negotiation or appeasement, or were they soldiers in a religious fight to the finish that had merely been paused for 500 years? Washington Irving, America's first international best-selling author, moved to Spain in 1826 at the invitation of the U.S. ambassador, Alexander Hill Everett. Irving had a genius for taking legends and folk tales and spinning them into popular literature. He had already written many of the stories that would lend him literary immortality, including Rip Van Winkle and the legend of Sleepy Hollow. Everett enticed him to write a history of Christopher Columbus's voyages to the New World, based on archival manuscripts that had become public. 3 years later, Irving took a trip from Seville to Granada. When he arrived at the ruins of the great Moorish fortress, the Alhambra, Irving was enchanted by the light, elegant, and voluptuous architecture. The geometric mosaics, the interplay of streams and fountains, the grand courtyards so thoughtfully blended with the landscape. Captivated by fables of a bygone empire, Irving took up residence in the unfurnished palace of Sultan Boabdil, the last of the Moorish rulers. Writing in these dilapidated quarters, with nothing but bats and owls flitting about, Irving began his imaginative narration. As conquerors, their heroism was only equaled by their moderation, he writes of the Islamic princes. They loved the land given them, as they supposed, by Allah, and strove to embellish it with everything that could administer to the happiness of man, laying the foundations of their power in a system of wise and equitable laws, diligently cultivating the arts and sciences, and promoting agriculture, manufactures, and commerce. They gradually formed an empire unrivaled for its prosperity by any of the empires of Christendom. These sentiments were unusual at a time when Islam was both obscure and disparaged in the West. But Irving was the herald of a new romanticism. After his best-selling book, Tales of the Alhambra, appeared in 1832, Moorish Spain became an object of veneration by painters, poets, and musicians, who now saw in the splendid ruins a vanished Camelot. "Such is the Alhambra," Irving writes, "a Muslim pile in the midst of a Christian land, an Oriental palace amidst the Gothic edifices of the West, an elegant memento of a brave, intelligent, and graceful people who conquered, ruled, and passed away." Irving's nostalgic portrait of the Alhambra was translated into Arabic, and his stories found their way into textbooks which would have been taught to the future leaders of Al-Qaeda. Less than a month after 9/11, Osama bin Laden and his chief lieutenant, Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, had appeared on Al Jazeera. "We will not accept that the tragedy of Al-Andalus will be repeated in Palestine," Zawahiri said, drawing an analogy between the expulsion of the Moors from Iberia and the present-day plight of the Palestinians. 2 months before the Madrid bombings, bin Laden issued a message to the Muslim people, which was broadcast on Al Jazeera. He lamented the decline of the Islamic world compared with Spain. "It is enough to know that the economy of all Arab countries is weaker than the economy of one country that had once been part of our world when we used to truly adhere to Islam. That country is the lost Al-Andalus." It is a paradox that bin Laden would glorify a civilization with values so starkly at odds with those he represents. His use of the archaic name Al-Andalus left most Spaniards nonplussed. "We took it as a folkloric thing," Ramon Perez Maura, an editor at ABC, told me. "We probably actually laughed." The Muslims who were expelled from 15th-century Spain took refuge mainly in Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. Some families, it is said, still have the keys to their houses in Cordoba and Seville. But the legacy of Al-Andalus persisted long after the diaspora. Up until the Victorian era, Spain was considered to be more a part of the Orient than of Europe. The language, the food, and the architecture were all deeply influenced by the Islamic experience. A rival history that Catholic Spain, despite its splendor, could never bury. In modern Arabic literature, Al-Andalus is seen as the lost paradise. Manuela Marin, a professor at the Consejo Superior de Investigaciones Científicas in Madrid, told me. "For Spain, the history of Al-Andalus has a totally different meaning. After all, what we know as Spain was made in opposition to the Islamic presence on the peninsula. Only recently have people begun to accept that Islam was a part of Spain." Although many Spanish historians have painted Moorish Spain as something other than paradise for Jews and Christians, for Muslims it remains not only a symbol of vanished greatness, but a kind of alternative vision of Islam, one in which all the ills of present-day Islamic societies are reversed. Muslim tourists, including many heads of state, come to Spain to imagine a time when Islam was at the center of art and learning, not on the fringes. The Alhambra is the number one Islamic monument. Malik A. Ruiz Callejas, the emir of the Islamic community in Spain and the president of Granada's new mosque, told me. "Back when in Paris and London people were being eaten alive by rats, in Cordoba, everyone could read and write. The civilization of Al-Andalus was probably the most just, most unified, and most tolerant in history, providing the greatest level of security and the highest standard of living." Imams sometimes invoke the glory of Al-Andalus in Friday prayers as a reminder of the price that Muslims paid for turning away from the true faith When I asked Monir El-Mezri of the M-30 mosque if the Madrid bombers could have been motivated by the desire to recapture Al-Andalus, he looked up sharply and said, "I can speak of the feeling of all Muslims. It was a part of history. We were here for 8 centuries. You can't forget it, ever." The fear that Moors would one day return and reclaim their lost paradise through either conquest or immigration is a paranoid theme in Spanish politics. Construction of the mosque in Granada was delayed for 22 years because of the intense anxiety surrounding the growing Islamic presence, which sharply increased after 1986 when Spain joined the European Union. Generous EU subsidies ignited an economic boom, drawing thousands of young men from North Africa. Smugglers in high-speed powerboats make nightly drop-offs on the ragged Spanish coastline, and the frequent discovery of corpses washing up on the beaches testifies to the desperation of those who did not quite get to shore. Muslim immigration is transforming all of Europe. This population is disproportionately young, male, and unemployed. The societies these men have left are typically poor, religious, conservative, and dictatorial. The ones they enter are rich, secular, liberal, and free. For many, the exchange is invigorating. But for others, Europe becomes a prison of alienation. A Muslim's experience of immigration can be understood in part by how he views his adopted homeland. Islamic thought broadly divides civilization into Dar al-Islam, the land of believers, and Dar al-Kufr, the land of impiety. France, for instance, is a secular democracy, largely Catholic, but it is now home to approximately 5 million Muslims. Should it therefore be considered part of the Islamic world? This question is central to the debate about whether Muslims in Europe can integrate into their new communities or must stand apart from them. If France can be considered part of Dar al-Islam, then Muslims can form alliances and participate in politics. They should have the right to institute Islamic law, and they can send their children to French schools. If it is a part of Dar al-Kufr, then strict Muslims must not only keep their distance, they must fight against their adopted country. The internet is the key issue. Gilles Kepel, a prominent Arabist and a professor at the Institut d'Études Politiques in Paris, told me. It erases the frontiers between the Dar al-Islam and the Dar al-Kufr. It allows the propagation of a universal norm with an internet sharia and fatwa system. Now, one doesn't have to be in Saudi Arabia or Egypt to live under the rule of Islamic law. Anyone can seek a ruling from his favorite sheikh in Mecca, Kepel said. In the old days, one sought a fatwa from the sheikh who had the best knowledge. Now it is sought from the one with the best website. To a large extent, Kepel argues, the internet has replaced the Arabic satellite channels as a conduit of information and communication. One can say that this war against the West started on television, he said. But, for instance, with the decapitation of the poor hostages in Iraq and Saudi Arabia, those images were propagated via webcams and the internet. A jihadi subculture has been created that didn't exist before 9/11. Though the internet has become an ideological home for many Muslims, for most Arab immigrants, Europe has provided comfort and support, while at the same time allowing them the freedom to maintain their Islamic identities. 3 Moroccan immigrants died on the trains on March 11th. One was a devout 13-year-old girl, Sanaa Ben Salah, for whom the M-30 mosque was said to have been her second home. Another, Mohammed Itabin, 27, was an illegal immigrant who taught Arabic classes at a mosque in Guadalajara. He was the sole source of support for his family, including 11 siblings, most of whom lived in a tiny town in Morocco where there were no telephones. The third, Osama El Amrati, was a builder who was engaged to a Spanish woman. Europe has given us opportunities our own countries didn't give us. Mustafa El Mrabet, the head of the Moroccan Workers and Immigrants Association, told me in Madrid, "Our children are in school and we are working. Thousands of families in Morocco can live with the money we get here." When I asked Mrabet if Al-Andalus was part of the lure for Moroccan immigrants, he said, "Nobody with common sense could talk about going back to that. It's madness. It's a disease." Under Aznar, relations with Morocco deteriorated to the point where in 2002, the countries broke off diplomatic relations over various problems, including territory disputes, immigration, and the flow of drugs into Europe through Spain. Eventually, the governments returned their ambassadors without resolving the disputes that had led to the rupture. When 12 suicide bombers struck in Casablanca in May 2003, killing 45 people, one of their targets was a restaurant called Casa de España. Spain is the bridge between the Islamic world and the West, Aizam Amira Fernandez said, when we met in a conference room at Madrid's Real Instituto Elcano, shortly after the train bombings. Think of that other bridge to the east, Turkey. Both have been hit by jihadist terrorists in the same week. In Istanbul on March 9th, two suicide bombers attacked a Jewish club, killing one person and injuring five others. The whole idea is to cut off these bridges, Amira said. If the goal is to polarize people, Muslims and infidels, that is a way of doing it. Jihadists are the most fervent defenders of the notion of a clash of civilizations. One evening, I went to a pub with some Spanish cops. There is this legend that Spain and the Arab world were friends, a senior investigator said. He nodded toward the waitress and the customers at several nearby tables. Here in the bar are five Arabs sitting next to you. Nobody used to think it was strange. Now people are reacting differently. He paused and said, they want to smell the jasmine of Al-Andalus and pray again in the Granada Mosque. Can you imagine the mentality these SOBs have? One of the most sobering pieces of information to come out of the investigation of the March 11th bombings is that the planning for the attacks may have begun nearly a year before 9/11. In October 2000, several of the suspects met in Istanbul with Amer Azizi, who had taken the nom de guerre Othman al-Andalusi, Othman of Al-Andalus. Azizi later gave the conspirators permission to act in the name of Al-Qaeda, although it is unclear whether he authorized money or other assistance, or indeed whether Al-Qaeda had much support to offer. In June, Italian police released a surveillance tape of one of the alleged planners of the train bombings, an Egyptian house painter named Rabe Osman Sayed Ahmed, who said that the operation took me 2.5 years. Ahmed had served as an explosives expert in the Egyptian army. It appears that some kind of attack would have happened even if Spain had not joined the coalition, or if the invasion of Iraq had never occurred. The real problem of Spain for Al-Qaeda is that we are a neighbor of Arab countries, Morocco and Algeria, and we are a model of economy, democracy, and secularism. Florentino Portero, a political analyst at the Grupo de Estudios Estratégicos in Madrid, told me, We support the transformation and westernization of the Middle East. We defend the transition of Morocco from a monarchy to a constitutional monarchy. We are allies of the enemies of Al-Qaeda in the Arab world. This point is not clearly understood by the Spanish people. We are a menace to Al-Qaeda just because of who we are.